Welcome back to Sunday Brass Tacks. This is Sanka Price here with you. Our producer is Mr. Dennis Johnson. We have in the studio Mr. Shane Lowe, the president of the Barbados Economic Society, and of course, Dr. George Bell, the political scientist, well noted. He's now retired dean. And on the telephone, we have Ms. Marla Dukaran, noted regional economist. And Dr. Bell made the point that human beings must be at the center of everything that we're planning going forward, especially when we talk about the IMF program. Now, one of the things that the Prime Minister Motley made is that keeping the exchange rate to the one peg at all costs. And I'm wondering, as Dr. Bell raised the point, how can we keep that, our exchange rate? How can we keep some of the social amenities that we have? And we're talking here about spending more money on pensions. We're talking about getting some more buses here, some more garbage trucks. How can we fix the South Coast Sewage Project? And of course, we're now hearing, of course, that the Bridgetown Sewage Plant is also giving us some problems. How can we do all of these things? Ms. Dukaran, you're familiar with some of these IMF programs. How can Barbados look about keeping this fixed exchange rate if we still want to keep all these things? I mean, what are your thoughts? And don't forget the human element.
Right. No, and that human element is so important that, I mean, the IMF really has not been operating the way recently that we know them to have operated, say, in the 80s, 70s, 80s, even in the 90s, so much so that in Barbados, for example, Jamaica has the most austere budget on the planet with a primary fiscal surplus of 7.7% of GDP, the IMF had set a certain floor, a certain minimum that Jamaica's government had to spend on social programs. So in other words, they could not cut social programs to their minimum. They had to maintain a certain amount of spending on social programs in order to save that impact on the population that that we fear could be negative. Now, so that I quite expect to be also part and parcel of the program that's being negotiated in Barbados. Now, with respect to your question on preserving the peg at any cost, if that is the policy imperative and priority of the administration that has just received an overwhelming, tremendous mandate from its electorate, then it means all the policies that have to be implemented to support that is what we will implicitly support. So, for example, the major driver of the outflow of U.S. dollars and the reduction in reserve has been fiscal spending. Fiscal spending is the major driver of the import bills, basically. And so what you have to do is fix the fiscal balance, which the Prime Minister said she wants to have a balanced budget by 2019. And we already outlined these major areas in which cuts will have to come in terms of wages and salaries, interest and debt service payments, subsidies and goods and services. Those are the main areas that I expect cuts will come from, and the transfers to loss-making state-owned enterprises being a significant one. So that, in my view, is the critical component of preserving the peg. You have to balance the fiscal account. The second most important thing is confidence, because part of the outflow of U.S. dollars has been people not wanting to hold U.S. dollars onshore or bring U.S. dollars onshore. They want to keep it offshore because they're afraid of what the economic scenario might bring. So you have to engender confidence. I believe that the policies that the current administration has outlined will engender and have already started to engender confidence, as we heard from Mr. Abed from
Thank you. We got cut off there. We have on the line though Mr. Jeremy Stephen, economist Jeremy Stephen. Jeremy, are you there?
I'm here. Hi. How are you doing?
Welcome. Good morning. I told them that you'll be joining us on the program. Have you been following so far?
Yeah. Good. I've been following.
And well, I'd like to get your thoughts on this whole thing. How can the government keep the peg and still achieve a number of the social objectives, bearing in mind that when we're talking cuts, we're talking human beings, as Dr. Bell demonstrated.
Yeah, you see, I can't even argue against the recommendations made by Marla just before she went off the lane. But again, then again, I'm not even 100% sure if she mentioning those things in chronological order, or if, as a matter of priority, what should come together. So for me, it is about balancing a budget, or less so balancing a budget, more about showing intent that you're willing to manage expenditure and reduce wastage. Balanced budget for me defeats the purpose of a government being a major cog. And if it is that Barbados wants to maintain the perception that it has a social safety net as a tenant of its society, of how its society is run, then a balanced budget to me is a lesser priority than just reducing wastage to the point where you can't afford to run a deficit, mainly because our deficit is primarily in Barbados dollars to begin with. So once you're able to control the expenditure, that reduces the need for money printing, in a sense, and therefore you could achieve one would hope by reprioritizing your expenditure towards better goods and services, reducing headcount in the civil service. I know people hate me to say that, but it's true. Then I figure you could have not necessarily a balanced budget, but a deficit budget that isn't based on a lot of wastage. The secondary thing would be continuing to engender confidence. Now, I use the big word engender, but I use it for a reason. Because confidence at the beginning of a term, especially after the change or the ousting of an unpopular government, is rather hyper, but irrational. So the problem is that you don't want to really, as a government, depend too much on people's irrationality going forward, because you have to make tough choices. So it's about being transparent, being fully communicative, and being sure that people understand why we are about to go through what we're about to go through. Businessmen always plan with some form of, let's say, projections in mind. And once you can guarantee some level of certainty, then you're sure that they may be a little better bringing money on shore. The worst thing you could ever do at the point that we are at, or have been for the last 3 years, is to be an unpredictable government. So being an unpredictable government means that the social partnership is never able to see what their role is and how they can invest going forward. So private investment will fall, and really and truly economy grows sustainably on the back of private sector investment, maybe from foreign direct investment, that being new opportunities coming from external investors in private assets and private opportunities, or if it is local domestic investors investing in debt, and more so investing in private capital projects. So those two steps that Marla was speaking to, they're very clear. I don't think that there's any other way generally that we can go about it. But again, I wait to hear what the surprises may be, or what the economic team of the Prime Minister is putting together. I don't know, for instance, after these defaults that were just announced on Friday, I think it is, that she might be, or the team might be, considering some form of debt swap. So, because private investors definitely were rattled. I know from overseas institutions that invest in our local debt and also in our foreign debt issues. And pretty much they were rattled. They claimed that it was unilaterally done, so therefore there was no discussion prior to them, prior to the action taken by the Prime Minister. That would have had them rattled. So again, they're looking for certainty. But for the Hawaii speaker, I said, well, look, just give her the 2 weeks that she requested before she reveals the implementation plan. But more importantly, I would say that given that action, because it's a very, very sharp action that, as we've seen, resulted in the downgrade from Carrie Christensen, certainly there may be more to come from the other agencies. It's just normal for that stuff to happen when you default on any form of foreign loan. So you may see a case where maybe they've got some sovereign debt alignment lined up, some kind of sovereign debt financing lined up. I don't know if it's a debt swap. I don't know if it's China. I don't know where the money's coming from. But to take such a, if you can excuse my French, a ballsy player like that, I figure that something has to be in the bag. And again, I wait. That's why I'm trying my best not to critique, but more so wait to see if more information comes up, just like how a private sector would do it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Jeremy. But you made the whole point about Kerry Chris doing the downgrade on that was yesterday, I think. I received that copy yesterday. But the point I made since last week that we Barbados has been overdue for a report from Moody's as well as S&P. If you recall, in March last year, they both downgraded Barbados. And they would normally have reported in March, but we had the dissolution of Parliament in March.
Yeah.
So really and truly, and since our situation has really worsened, there's no doubt in my mind that we were going to have a downgrade anyhow from S&P and Moody's. So you know, it's just a matter of time. Shane Lowe, your thoughts on this whole thing in terms of going forward? And at all costs, keeping the peg.
Yeah, well, I think and I suspect that the action on Friday was also interesting enough in the short term to maintain the peg. Mm-hmm. The challenge is that if you and you know we can discuss what other options there were to announcing not continue to pay foreign debt, but I suppose, from the rationale of the government's perspective, if you continue to pay the foreign debt, which is the thing that's been pushing down the reserves, you reduce the reserves and increase the probability that the peg will go. So in the short term, it was a you know, kind of a trade-off between do we push the reserves even further down than where they are now, or do we potentially cause another downgrade? And we saw one yesterday.
But were pending anyhow.
They were pending. But I think with Moody's, if you look at the Moody's report, Moody's had already baked in the fact that the government might be defaulting going forward. If you look at S&P has a higher rating on the foreign debt than on the domestic debt. Mm-hmm. So I think they were more looking at there would be a restructuring on the domestic debt. But now this action now suggests that there's going to be a wholesale restructuring, which will more likely see S&P respond on the foreign currency rating rather than the local rating. I think the two things, which is the IMF program and the fiscal adjustment and maintain the peg, all those things are very consistent. The IMF provides a foreign exchange that allows you to maintain the foreign exchange that you need to protect the peg. And of course, the fiscal adjustment will, as Marla said, and Jeremy also spoke to it, it improves the confidence for both foreign and domestic investors. Now, I just wanted to make a point on the impact of the IMF on the average person. Marla mentioned the floors that the IMF put, the minimum spending floors on social services in the Jamaica program, and they also did it in the Grenada program. And my understanding is that that is now a common thing with IMF programs. And the reason for that is the IMF now views the whole issue of inequality as very important to economic growth. The reality is that an IMF program, because it targets social spending sometimes and additional taxes, can be harsher on those in society who depend more on those social programs. So a person who's very wealthy can secure private health care if they need to. They might have health insurance. A person who is not very wealthy might have to depend on the state-owned polyclinics or hospital. So by maintaining that social spend, you ensure that those that depend on those areas can still access them. But what it means is that you have to be very targeted, and you cannot then allow all and sundry, the wealthy, middle class, and those in between, to also access those services. So it's more reprioritizing of expenditure and reducing expenditure than just a across the board cut and everybody suffers.
So in other words, can we be looking at possibly user fees at the hospital, where even at the university, where we assess who can pay and from who can't pay? I think
a
possibility?
Yeah, and that's why I quoted the IMF, which said further measures aimed at cost recovery, which essentially means that the state-owned entities charge and are able to recover the costs of what they're providing. So again, I don't know what entities they will be. And certainly this is just what the IMF has said, but an IMF program involves some negotiation between the government and the IMF. And the current government might have other ideas in terms of the burden they want to place on social services versus taxation and things like that. But I think you'd expect to see that going forward. There might have, there will have to be some cost recovery, some user fees on some services.
But the thing that strikes me as an average person is that here you have a situation where we are in debt, things are not getting any better, mm-hmm. and you need to lift the entire country up. The pensioners at the bottom, this is non-contributory pensioners, they really find it tough to survive. Mm-hmm. So you have to deal with them. At the same time, we have young people. You want to ensure that they are well-trained, they get the education they need. So they have to be provided for as well. You can't put a burden on them in terms of they looking for certain, you know, money, because there's very little money circulating there. At the same time, you want to ensure that the vast majority of your population can go from point A to point B in public transport that is heavily subsidized. You want to ensure that the country stays healthy, because the garbage is collected, because as you know, there is a rat infestation all over. That has been made quite clear already, and there are programs trying to eradicate it. And then of course, people must be able to go to the hospital to get treatment, and there must be drugs available, pharmaceutical drugs that is, to be able to take care of them. And yet we're still talking cuts. Mm-hmm. This is a conundrum.
Well, let me.
I think one of the problems again is changing your development perspective. Okay, we in Barbados are in a little country, in 160 square miles, and we have this vision that we are going to do this great economic analysis on this 160 square miles and these 280,000 people. If you continue with this closed vision, you are going to eat yourselves eventually. It is compelling that we have to go to a regional focus. And that is not anything new, but it's something that has collapsed more than once in the Caribbean. And we are not the only people in the Caribbean that are in that condition. A lot of the islands in the Eastern Caribbean are too small, especially in the context of world economy right now, to be viable in relation to their base, the economic base, the resource base, the population base. Barbados is one of them that is very much like that, but it is the one that can do a lot of leveraging in the in relation to saying, let's get back to the original question. We have to start to think, you see this concept about building the islands offshore, it looks like, you know, something just for the tourism thing and so on, but it is to do with how are you going to get Barbados to be bigger. Now, you can get Barbados to be bigger by going up in the air. You can get Barbados to be bigger by integrating with other islands and countries where your people can move, where you can bring resources that right now you think you don't have, where you can utilize spaces that other people don't have to use, like let's say in Guyana and Dominica and so on, and where we can move to bigger population areas, where areas again like Guyana where they need people. If we start to think in that way and stop thinking in relation to autarky, that everything is about Barbados and how you can get Barbados to work. Barbados eventually will not be able to work because it's too small. That is the problem. And you're going on with all of these modeling and struggling with balancing this and how you're going to deal with that and how you can pay for that because you're too small. That's the problem. And you need to get bigger. And the way to get bigger is to try to force the hand on the regionalism. Well, the main problem with what I'm saying is that how can we get the other people to think regional as well? Now, have we tested that in recent years? For about 10 years now, this regionalism thing has been on stall. And we have to try to get to people that it is a desperate position in relation to policy now. Now, we have to talk to the Jamaicans in particular because they feel they can still ride alone, although they have all these strong ties with the Eastern Caribbean, and they make a whole lot out of regional integration too. The Trinidadians historically are always there, but we always frustrate them. up to the last time where a major effort was being made, we frustrated Eric Williams and we frustrated Patrick Manning. And it is about time that the Caribbean, the English-speaking Caribbean, and the peoples of the eastern English-speaking Caribbean recognize that the little territories, the indigenous people knew that. They didn't used to stop at Barbados. They used to go all the up through the whole archipelago. And we are here on this little rock and thinking that we are the world and we can build some economy out of it that is going to be able to support the population. We either going to reduce the population, go back to subsistence farming, go back to eating cassava and drinking goat milk, or we're going to expand like Singapore without all of the other cultural problems that somewhere like Singapore has. But to do that, you're going to have to go regional. You know what? Singapore broke away from a federation. But we have to go into one. And that may sound dramatic and difficult, but that is one of the biggest problems, which the economists are not talking about because they're all trapped in this little model about Barbados and its 166 square miles and its 280,000 people.
Okay. Jeremy. Yeah, go ahead, Jeremy.
I need to stop my vomiting there because I will have my vomiting embellish the statements on here. Because I, for instance, you know this, Tiger, I've been pushing regionalism and pushing the importance of Guyana and regionalism for at least 7 years now. And also, just to add to this point, cause I agree with you holistically, you know, Dr. Bell. But I want to state emphatically that the attack has to be two-pronged. If you want to federalize, the attack has to be two-pronged simply based on the distance each island has from each other. Logistically, we, and I will say this again for probably the 10th time on Brass Tacks, we can actually, as a country, become a world leader in transshipment and logistics opportunities, which is why that port deal with Global Ports Inc. alleged, because again, I haven't seen the facts per se, but the alleged port deal with Global Ports Inc. to me is a step 30 years back, right? The particular deal you could discuss if it's part of where the program needs to go. But as it stands right now, we have to invest in our port. We can invest in Guyana. We can send what we call high skilled labor down to Guyana to help with the agricultural end and the oil end of the business down there. But when it comes to regional transport, Barbados is actually a key nexus. If you want to speak to history, the Atlantic slave trade, first stop, Dr. Bell, you could tell me if I was wrong, always was here. Right? First stop was here, and anybody else went off to the other islands, as the case would be. So the English recognized a long time ago the importance with respect to transshipment of, unfortunately, human capital, if you want to call it that, slavery, slaves. But now, with the widening of the Panama Canal and the creation of another canal in Nicaragua, there's literally going to be a quadrupling of trade passing by the region. Jamaica capitalized on it. 3 years ago, they got a Chinese company, the Chinese Harbor Engineering Company, I think it is, to invest in their gold islands off of Kingston. So that's why Jamaica all of a sudden is counting on transshipment to help revitalize the economy, and it has begun to do so. The Bahamas has run transshipment from the United States of America because of the Jones Act, meaning there are no two ships. There's no ship that can dock directly at two ports in the States, with the exception of some ports. And so therefore, anything leaving Miami always stops off in the Bahamas, and the Bahamas has been making a lot of money off of that. Any trade moving between Western Africa and China literally is cheaper to pass through the Caribbean than via the Panama Canal. And we lay along the shortest distance between the Panama Canal and the Suez Canal in the Middle East and London. And literally, if Barbados wanted to go alone, it should have put all its money there in expanding that port and all the islands that the BLP manifesto was relating to. If we don't want to go it alone, a mixture of our relationship with Guyana, given they're about to be oil boom, and transshipment is literally enough to transform Barbados for a few years, along with other industries that would benefit from that major expansion. Why would I have Dr. Bell, who I look up to, make the mistake that others made by saying that certain things haven't been discussed where they have been widely discussed?
Mm-hmm. All right, thank you, Jeremy. The fact, though, is that I think that we are on the right track in terms of integration, because we had something like four prime ministers here and one deputy prime minister. And the fact that they would have dropped whatever they were doing just to be in Barbados, to be there with in terms of the whole ceremony on Sunday, suggests to me that at least they're looking towards Barbados to again be the beacon within the Eastern Caribbean. But I want to look more in, more immediately at private sector-led growth and the, how the public sector reforms will allow that, because we're going into an IMF program or some sort of association with the IMF. And Marla, are you there? We lost you for
I'm
a
here.
Moment.
I'm
okay.
Here.
How about look at private sector-led growth and public sector reforms to allow that? Would you like to comment on that?
Yes. I mean, when we talk about the cuts that we need to have in the government expenditure program, of course, wages, the wage bill will be cut. Now, whether that will be cut in terms of headcount or in terms of the wages themselves, salary cuts, I am not sure which way it will go. I have expressed my view before that I think it would be better to preserve headcount and cut wages, and then you have a deliberate rationalization of the public sector afterwards. Now, however it happens, let's be clear that government spending does not generate growth in an economy like Barbados or in any economy in the Caribbean. And that is because of something called fiscal leakage. Out of every dollar that the government spends, roughly 80 to 90 cents leaks out in the form of imports. So government spending does not create growth. What creates growth in economies like ours is investment and export. And to encourage investment, you need confidence and you need the private sector to believe that they will be able to recoup their investments and earn a return on their investments. To do that, you need the public sector reforms that are necessary to help the private sector to flourish. In other words, you need to be able that for when businesses come in to register, they can do that easily and quickly. They can achieve building permits, licenses, electricity, tax, file their taxes, all of these things that businesses have to do that they sometimes spend days, weeks, and months doing. We need to be able to retool the public sector, reform the public sector to allow private sector to spend more time doing what they do best and to do so efficiently. And that's what I think I want to look forward to in Barbados from this IMF program, as they have done in Jamaica, where all of these doing business reforms from things to the port, all the way through the public sector, that allows for businesses to flourish. When businesses flourish, they will hire more people. They become more efficient, they grow, and they hire more people, so that the jobs that might be displaced or the wages that might have suffered in the public sector can now be made up for in the private sector via private sector-led growth and businesses flourishing. And that's what I think we really need to focus on in Barbados. Job creation cannot happen sustainably. Growth cannot happen sustainably in the public sector. It has to come from the private sector.
You mentioned something which I think a lot of people will hang on to, because I understand the point you're making. I think it's a very valid point. But you mentioned cut wages instead of cutting people. That goes right back to the 1990s when Prime Minister Erskine Sandiford had the 8% cut. Of course, the legislation was adjusted so that that could not happen again. But the Motley-led government has more than a two-thirds majority. They have the whole majority. And I'm just throwing it out there, gentlemen, if you want to talk about that. Should, in terms of the social partnership, if they're on board, what is the likelihood of this happening? Or should they be examining this as one of the issues? But before we answer, any of you answer that, believe me, we need to take a break right now. I just need to remind you that this program is brought to you with the kind compliments of Williams Industries, Inc.